I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hillstring Gang, Rango the Three.
Hey, everyone, and welcome back to Bloody
Angola,
a podcast 142 years in the making.
The complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
And I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton. Thank you all for listening and liking and sharing. Please continue to do so. Leave us a review wherever you listen up in your podcast. And Patreon members, we appreciate y'all. You rock. Thank you for your continued support. This one, we're going back to one that got a whole lot of interest.
People loved it.
And, well, I love it.
Yeah.
I guess you're twisted to your arm, right? And we're going to tell you about
Death Chamber
stuff.
Yeah, and part two.
Execution. Yeah, Death Chamber part two.
Part duh. Yeah, so we're going to get into it and what we do with these folks. And if you hadn't listened yet, you can go back and listen to Death Chamber Part 1. The good thing about these is we cover just individual convicts that were executed at Angola. We tell just a little synopsis of their crime, and they got some really interesting final words in there for these guys.
And things like that.
And people just loved it the first time, so we're going to continue with it. And I'll start out with our first convict up for, I guess, grabs today, and that is Leslie Lowenfield. And Leslie Lowenfield was executed in 1988, and he rode the lightning.
I graduated
electrocuted. High school. Yep. Gruesome Gertie. Had a seat in that chair. And to tell you a little bit about this this guy, he was a native of Ghana. He came to Louisiana from Canada in 1981, and he met his primary victim, which was a lady named Sheila Thomas.
He's well-traveled. I think Ghana is like in Africa or somewhere.
Yeah, then he goes to Canada.
And then he comes to to Louisiana.
He figured it out. He figured out the USA was where he wanted to be, I guess. And we didn't want him here after.
Until
he
met Gruesome Gertie.
Yeah. Sheila Thomas was his primary victim. She was a deputy sheriff in Jefferson Parish, Louisiana, which is around the New Orleans area.
Yeah, it's a huge, actually, it's one of the largest parishes geographically because it expands all the way around Orleans, all the way down to Grand Isle. Did you know Grand Isle was in Jefferson Parish?
I did not.
Absolutely. It cuts across all that marsh and everything else. So land-wise, Tangipahoa is the longest parish in the state. North and south, but I think JP is the biggest.
Interesting. I didn't know Tangi was the longest.
Tangi is the longest state, north to south. Yeah, I mean, longest parish, north to south.
Very interesting. So, Sheila Thomas was a deputy sheriff, and Miss Thomas, along with her daughter, young daughter, who was Chantel Osborne, moved in with Lowenfield in the summer of 1981. So, you can already see, Lowenfield and Miss Thomas, they lived together off and on for about a year. During that year, Miss Thomas left Lowenfield on three separate occasions and returned to live with her mother. So they're probably fighting, having arguments. Yeah. Lowenfield became increasingly bitter following each separation. So every time she would leave, he would get more and more pissed.
Right.
When Miss Thomas returned to her mother's home for the last time, he repeatedly threatened and harassed Miss Thomas and her mother, victim Myrtle Griffin. In the late afternoon of August 30th, 1982, Owen Griffin, Sheila Thomas's stepfather was in a vacant lot near his home in Marrero, which is outside of like an outskirts of New Orleans. Yeah. He was playing cards with friends. Owen Griffin, all of a sudden, he hears shots ring out from their home.
Right.
He runs to the house, rushed inside, where more shots were fired. When police arrived, they found five bodies sprawled about the living room area of the house. They found the bodies of Sheila Thomas, her four-year-old daughter, Chantel, Owen Griffin, his wife, Myrtle Griffin, and Carl Osborne, who was the father of Chantel. All of the victims had sustained multiple gunshot wounds. Each had been shot in the head at close range.
That's crazy. But think about that last seconds when you're sitting there and whatever pops off and he shoots the first one. You're like, what the? And then boom, 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 boom.
Just round, right? Blast.
You're just sitting there. You mean, I'm sure some of them are trying to scramble and get away. But he's close enough to shoot him in the head.
No doubt about it.
No mercy, animal.
No mercy and total animal. And he goes to court, gets convicted, gets sentenced to death. And eventually, as a matter of fact, in 1988, he does get executed. And his final statement included remarks directed at his two attorneys, Wayne Walker and John Kraft, who had worked on his trial and appeal. His last words were, "I hope you feel satisfied. Don't give up on me. Although my life will be over tonight because the one responsible is out there."
Wow.
Yeah. Deny it to the end, right? There is no reason to hold anything against me and the rest who would lie. When I'm gone, the body will be gone, but the spirit will live on. Mr. Walker and John Kraft, your job was more important than my life. I hope you feel satisfied. Thank you to all of you and peace.
Did he say peace?
He said peace. That was his final words. Peace, how right, dare him
right,
use
right
our...
Right to hell,
yeah.
Use our moniker.
But here's an interesting thing about this entire case. Dale Brown, the head basketball coach at that time, actually attended his execution.
Really? I didn't know that.
They had been corresponding since Dale Brown toured Angola years earlier with the LSU basketball team, actually became friends, and... He attended that execution. Wow, I found that very interesting.
So that was, the real deal execution. You know, Gruesome Gertie, I got to sit in probably around that same time in the chair, but not obviously get executed. But think about the difference between what they do now, where they just put them to sleep.
Yeah.
And the Gruesome Gertie, they strap you in and you know you're about to ride.
Lights.
Off. On. They don't just hit him once. They did it like three, four, five times. And so, fuck him. And he got what he deserved.
Yeah. That's and don't crazy. Use our peace anymore.
Yeah, no, don't use our peace. Tell the devil peace, you bitch.
That's right.
All right. I'm going to take you to a guy named Timothy Baldwin. And the date of the murder was April the 4th, 1978. And he killed a lady named Mary James Peters. Now, what's unusual about this? Killing one person and getting a death penalty? Well, Mary James Peters was 85 years old. That's bad, right?
Yeah.
But
elderly.
She was blind.
Oh, my God.
Right? And
that's horrible.
He beat her to death with a skillet, a stool, a small television, and a telephone. Right? And this happened you would think me being retired from state police, I would have all these pronunciations correctly, but I'm going to say this one wrong because every time I say it, somebody corrects me. But I say Wichita Parish, Louisiana, which is, y'all, is all the way up northeast in Louisiana, great fishing and hunting. And he was electrocuted in Louisiana on September 10th, 1984. Now, let me tell you about the case. Timothy Baldwin and his wife, Rita, and their seven children were neighbors of Mary James Peters in West Monroe, Louisiana. Again, y'all, that's way northeast Louisiana. From 1971, he was roommates with them in 1971 to 1977. Miss Peters was godmother to their youngest, Russell. During the later part of their stay in West Monroe, William Odell Jones also resided with the Baldwins. Okay, the group went to Bossier City for 6 months. Now, Yalbosia City is on the other end of the north part of the state by Shreveport. All right, so probably about a three-hour drive. The group went to Bossier City for 6 months and then moved to Ohio. The oldest daughter, Michelle, remained in West Monroe with one brother. A second son entered the service, and Marilyn Hampton and her three daughters stayed with the Baldwins in Ohio. Marilyn, Timothy Baldwin, and her children then left, accompanied by Jones. Baldwin and Jones worked together in the business of installing aluminum siding. After the departure of her husband, Rita Baldwin got into financial difficulties and was picked up on bad check charges. Her four younger children went to live with Michelle in West Monroe. Meanwhile, Timothy Baldwin, or bad guy, Jones, Marilyn Hampton, and her three children led an alternate existence. Their last means of transportation was a 1978 black Ford van, which had been rented in Tampa, Florida. Mm-hmm. On April 4th, 1978, Marilyn Hampton and Timothy Baldwin drove the van to West Monroe. Jones and the children stayed at a cabin in the Holmes State Park near Jackson, Mississippi. Baldwin, Jackson, Mississippi is not that far. Wichita, or however you want to say it, and the Monroe is pretty much on the Mississippi, Mississippi, Louisiana, and just north of that is the Arkansas line. So about an hour from there to Jackson. So Baldwin and Marilyn Hampton visited Michelle's apartment in West Monroe, but left there at 8 p.m. Shortly thereafter, a van was seen parked in front of Miss Peters' house. A man and a woman were observed leaving the residence between 10 o'clock and 11 o'clock p.m. Shortly before their departure, a passerby saw and heard indications that someone in Peters' home was being beaten. Baldwin testified in his own behalf and admitted that he and Marilyn visited Miss Peters that evening but denied the murder. Miss Peters, who was 85 years old, was beaten with various things, among them a skillet, a stool, and a telephone.
Oh, my God. And this is a blind one.
Right, right, right.
She doesn't even know it's coming at her.
Right. Yeah, that's
poor.
That's
thing.
Unimaginable, right?
Poor lady.
I think about the one I had, Miss Nini, had the 57 blows. It was from a base and a Coke bottle, but she was on a walker and stuff, but at least she could see it coming. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. That's awful.
Anyway, she remained on the kitchen floor overnight and was discovered the next morning shortly before noon by an employee of the Wichita Council Meals on Wheels who were bringing her noon meal. Although helpless and incoherent, Miss Peters tried to defend herself against the police officers and the ambulance attendant who took her to the hospital.
Poor woman, right? Man.
She doesn't know who they are.
Yeah.
Dr. A.B. Gregory saw her in the emergency room around 12:30 p.m. on April 5th, 1978, and found her in a semi-comatose. Her left cheekbone and jawbone were shattered. She had brain damage from multiple contusions and lacerations. According to Dr. Gregory, Miss Peters could not communicate rationally. She died of the injuries the following day. Dr. Frank Chin, who performed the autopsy, attributed her death to massive cerebral hemorrhage and swelling secondary to external head injuries. So she brain bleeds what ultimately killed her, and it didn't kill her instantly. Can you imagine that?
Mm-hmm.
Laying there on the floor all night. Timothy Baldwin and Marilyn Hampton were subsequently located in El Dorado, Arkansas. Remember, y'all, I told you Arkansas is just north. Timothy Baldwin signed consents for search of the motel room and the van. Two blue bank bags, one empty and one containing savings bonds and certificates of deposits payable to Mary James, were found in the van. Jones, to whom Marilyn Hampton and Timothy Baldwin had made statements both before and after the crime, helped police officers locate a safe that had belonged to the victim in the Lafourche Canal in West Monroe. Baldwin's fingerprints and palm prints were found on various items in a Peter's home, a cigarette lighter, a television set, and a coffee cup. Baldwin was found guilty, and the jury did what they should have. They recommended the death sentence. So, Timothy George Baldwin was executed on September 10th, 1984. Baldwin was convicted of beating to death the 85-year-old blind woman, Mary James Peters. And Peters, who was a former neighbor of Baldwin's and the godmother of his youngest child, was beaten with everything I told y'all about. Baldwin maintained the sentence and gave this final statement. He said, I've always tried to be a good sport when I've lost at something, and I see no reason not to leave this world with the same policy. After all, it was a hell of a battle. I therefore congratulate all those who have tried so hard to murder me. I definitely have to give them credit, as it takes a very special kind of person to murder an innocent man and still be able to live with themselves. You know,
victim city, huh?
Burning in hell.
Yeah.
Right? But I'm going to tell you something.
Hell or jail, as you say.
Hell or jail. But, you know, you go through all these years. He sat on death row for a lot shorter time than they do now.
Yeah.
And you know you're strapped down, and that's going to be your last words. I'm thinking about trying to find me some Jesus.
Amen.
And even if I don't believe him, be like, Lord, if you could please forgive me if you're really there and bring me home. But he's saying, I didn't do it.
What a horrible human. Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're getting real on this one. Right. Look, these guys, they were executed. So you're going to hear some disturbing stuff. Yeah. But we're real with this stuff.
Executed for a reason.
That's right. Yeah. I'm going to tell you about Sterling Rault. And Sterling Rault was executed, y'all, by electrocution, gruesome Gertie, in 1987, August 24th, to be exact. And this is an interesting case because a lot of these guys that end up on death row and executed, you know, they come from really hard upbringings, and a lot of them didn't have money their whole lives. And Sterling Rault was a little bit different. He had a good job. He was a controller at a company called Lutex. And there was a lady there named Janie Franzoni. And Mike, if he were here, could help me pronounce that Italian last name. But we're gonna go with Franzoni. She worked as a secretary. On the evening of March 1st, 1982, which was a Monday, fellow employees observed Rault and Franzoni leaving work together in her car. Less than an hour later, three UNO students, which is University of New Orleans, yep, they saw the two struggling in the campus parking lot. Franzoni screamed at the students, asked them to call police and make him leave her alone because he was attempting rape. The students closest to the car observed what appeared to be splashes of blood on her clothing. Rault repeatedly said he had to get her to the hospital before throwing her in the car from the driver's side all the way to the passenger side.
He was driving away. In front of the witnesses. I got to get her to the hospital.
Basically grabbed her, threw her so hard into the car, she went straight into the passenger seat. So he was probably a strong guy.
Right.
Approximately 9:20 that evening, a state trooper driving north on Paris Road in an isolated area of New Orleans East stopped to investigate what appeared to be a brush fire and discovered a burning female body.
Worst way.
Close by were partially used 5-gallon cans of gasoline and Franzoni's blood-stained car, which smelled strongly of gasoline. So he's trying to burn the car and her. A spent bullet was even found on the floor of the car. The victim had a man's belt wrapped around her neck and a jagged wound on the right side of her neck. She had been shot twice. One bullet had struck her in the thigh, traveling into the abdomen through a small intestine, stomach, and liver before exiting the left side of her chest. The pathologist actually testified that this would have caused extensive slow bleeding. The wound would have been very painful and would have resulted in death in less than a matter of hours. The second bullet entered directly into the abdomen. It damaged blood vessels on the right kidney and a large blood vessel known as the anterior vena cava before lodging into the spine, and would have also caused really rapid bleeding. That wound would have been fatal in 5 or 10 minutes. So what we're painting a picture of here is how, you know, she suffered. It wasn't It's just horrible. The victim was dead.
Twice, yeah.
Yeah. The victim was dead when the neck wound was inflicted and she was set on fire. Thank God. Mm. Her fingernail scrapings had human blood on them. So she fought.
Right.
She's a fighter. Janie Franzoni had been with her mother and a friend during the preceding weekend and had no sexual encounters. I'm sure they tested for that. Her mother took her to work. On Monday morning, however, she had engaged in sexual activity 12 to 24 hours prior to her death. Vaginal swab showed semen fluid, but no sperm. Sterling Rault had a vasectomy in 1979. When police searched the area, they detected movement under a nearby bridge. As they approached, a man broke out and ran. After a brief chase, he turned around, threw up his hands, and hollered, "I'm Sterling Rault."
Ran like a bitch.
Yeah. He appeared quiet, calm, and relaxed. He was dressed in casual clothing. He was lacking a belt. Woody's detective brain can put two and two together on that one. And he had a strong aroma of gasoline. So, you know, there were several fresh red scratch marks across his chest. His right hand was swollen. After being advised of his rights, he claimed two men in ski masks kidnapped him and Franzoni and raped her, of course. Testimony at the trial revealed Rault had been embezzling funds from Lutex, and his secretary was about to basically write him out. So in December of 1981, a 25 caliber semi-automatic weapon had been sold to a buyer with a driver's license in the name of Jerry Jones. In executing the search of Rault's residence, they recovered a gun box for the pistol, a box of 25 caliber cartridges, a Mississippi driver's license in the name of Jerry Jones. So there it is. They end up taking him to court, obviously, and he gets the death penalty. So he got executed on August 24th, 1987. He was convicted of raping, stabbing, shooting, and burning the body of Jane Ellen Franzoni, a 21-year-old secretary, as we told you. And his final statement was, "I would like the public to know that they are killing an innocent man at this time."
Three for three. How innocent, huh?
Crazy. "I pray that God will forgive all those involved." How nice of you.
Right.
"I personally do not hold any animosity towards anyone. The country professes to be one nation under God, but the death penalty goes against the word of God." Into the arms
of... So does murder and shooting a lady twice and choking her, you know, with a belt and everything else.
Yeah. "Into the arms of God I go now. I love you all. May God bless you all." And there was a little write-up in the paper, you know, shortly after these, and it was interesting because he was fighting to try to get these stays of execution, as are typical, but unsuccessful, and he rode the lightning as he deserved.
I'm so glad Grissom Gertie was still involved in all these stories. I just think that's such a good way for them to go. And I know so many people hate the death penalty, and I don't want anybody that's innocent. But these people,
you hear some of these stories, and you know what?
It's like having a migraine. Everybody knows about about murder. But unless you're going through it, unless it's your loved one, I've seen people who said before their family members got murdered, they were against the death penalty, and after their family members got murdered, they wanted the death penalty.
Yeah,
yeah. You understand it, but you don't get it.
That's right.
Well. Let's take it to our next winner, Antonio James. And y'all, he's a murderer during some robberies, and he killed two people in January the of 23rd of 1979 and was arrested on the 26th of 1979. He was born in 54, so he was 64, 74, so he was like 24, 25. And this happened in Orleans Parish, and he actually, this winner, got lethal injection instead of Grissom Gertie. Got the needle. Let me tell you about it. So James had amassed a very extensive juvenile and criminal record by the time he was tried for the murder of, and we'll get, he murdered two people, y'all, Henry Silver, age 70, and Alan Adams. I don't know what Adams' age was. But James had amassed a very extensive juvenile and criminal record by the time he was tried for the murder of Silver. The post-sentence investigation report, let me tell you about that. Did you know that anytime you get convicted of any crime, especially you're going to do a lot of time, there's actually a division of the parole officers and probation officers who do what they call a PSI, pre-sentence investigation report on you, and they tell you, your whole prior criminal history, work history and everything else, drug use, whatever, and then they write a synopsis on whether that to tell the judge whether or not they're likely to offend again.
Yeah.
So that helps the judge determine how many years or whatever they're going to give them. Unless it's automatic life in prison. The post-sentence investigation report prepared for the sentencing court listed 37 juvenile incidents. 37. That's the ones that they called them for, bro. That's the ones that they called them for. Think about all the ones he got away with.
Probably double it.
Right. James was ordered confined to Louisiana Training Institute at age 14. And y'all, that is basically the Angola. Or we need to
come LTI.
LTI. that was right down the road from me. Mm-hmm. We need it. We're going to actually cover that one day because that's some real shit there, too. But most of these guys, a lot of them go to death row. But anyway, he was locked up in basically juvenile prison, which was a very bad place, at age 14. In 1973, he was convicted of attempted armed robbery and sentenced to serve 3 years at the state penitentiary. During this period of confinement, he was convicted of attempted simple escape. He was released in 1975. I don't understand all these years because, I mean, armed robbery carries 99, attempted, I think, is 40 up to. And then the simple escape alone is 10 years. But anyway, he was released in 1975. In 1978, he was charged with aggravated rape. That's a mandatory life, if not death penalty. But the charge was later refused by the prosecution. James was convicted of the first-degree murder of Alvin Adams on January 23rd of 79 and was sentenced to life imprisonment. Okay? The first-degree murder, he could have got the death penalty. He was convicted on January 26th of 79, so just, shit, 3 days later? An armed robbery of Robert Hooten and was sentenced to 99 years for this offense, the maximum under Louisiana law.
Mm.
Now, we go to Henry Silver. On January 1, 1979, James approached 70-year-old Henry Silver as the latter was getting out of his car in his neighborhood in New Orleans. James placed a gun to Silver's head and demanded his money. When Silver shouted for help, James placed a gun under Silver's right ear, cocked the hammer, and fired a shot into Silver's head. James then rifled through Silver's pockets and removed his wallet containing $35. He drove away in a nearby waiting car. Silver died a few hours later at Charity Hospital. Now, let me tell y'all this, and I used to go there all the time back in the day. It's closed now after Katrina, but Charity Hospital was rated as the number one trauma center in the world for gunshots and stabs. Yeah. You know why? Because it handled all New Orleans shit. In the 90s, New Orleans was the murder capital of the world.
Yeah.
So I've seen some crazy shit in there. But anyway, he obviously lived on the machine for overnight. James was arrested on January 26, 1979, when he bungled another armed robbery attempt and was shot with his own gun. He was indicted for the first-degree murder. At trial by Orleans Parish Grand Jury, The Orleans Parish Grand Jury indicted him first degree murder. In December 1981, the jury found him guilty as charged at a trial where the principal witness against James was his accomplice, Levon Price. After deliberation, the same jury unanimously recommended that the defendant be sentenced to death, rightfully so.
Yeah.
So let's go to March 1st, 1996, all these years later. That's 15 years later. James was executed by lethal injection at the Louisiana State Penitentiary. Listeners know it as Bloody Angola. At the age of 42. The execution team had difficulty locating a vein to insert the catheter into his arm in order to commence the execution. Our hero, Warden Burl Kane, requested that James make a fist in order to assist the process. James complied to this request. James declined to give a final statement. However, when Warden Kane later said that James stated, "Bless you," as he was strapped to the execution gurney. His last meal, fried oysters and crab gumbo.
Wow, good choice.
Good choice.
I'll say that.
Made me hungry.
Yeah, it tastes.
James' execution was the subject of an ABC News documentary on Primetime Live in the UK. The BBC broadcast a 40-minute piece on April 18th, 1996, on Radio 4 about the case, with particular reference to the role of the British lawyer Clive Stafford Smith in providing adequate defense. So there you go.
Yeah, and Antonio James, we talked about him a little bit. On our, which if you look, go back and listen to that series, the Burrow Kane series, we just wrapped up.
Three or four parts.
Well, it was three parts.
Three parts, and then me and KJ, so it's four parts.
Yeah, so the patron, we did an episode with Kelly Jennings.
That's right.
And only available to patron. We said, go join that patron and listen to that one. But we discussed Antonio James, and it was interesting. That was the second execution for Burrow Kane, and the one that he said, I'm going to do this one right.
Right, because his first one. Yeah, y'all go listen to the series.
It's really good.
Super powerful. Burrow, we're still waiting on you to come on the show, buddy.
And you know what I noticed about that whole thing? Yes, we are. What I noticed about that whole thing is he's the first one we've come across today that didn't blame it. Other people.
Yeah, that's right. The first one, and then he just said, "God bless," and God bless, and riding out.
Yep.
And the
at least took it like a man. Yep. That's right. So John Ashley Brown, let's get to him. And John Ashley Brown was executed by lethal injection in April of 1997. Tell you a little bit about this crime. On the night of the murder, Mr. Laughlin and his wife had eaten dinner at a restaurant near the corner of Dauphine and Torres Streets in New Orleans. Very famous area of New Orleans. At approximately 11:45 p.m., they left the restaurant and began walking to their car, which was located about a block away. Brown exited a nearby vehicle, and he confronted the Laughlins. He pinned them against the car and demanded money from Mr. Laughlin. Miss Laughlin screamed and ran back towards the restaurant. When she returned to the scene, her husband was dead.
Yeah.
According to NOPD, who had arrived at the location, the victim was found lying face down in the street and bleeding profusely. Mm. An autopsy later revealed that Mr. Laughlin had been stabbed 13 times.
A lot.
Miss Laughlin provided the police with a description of the perpetrator and the vehicle which she had seen him get out of prior to the attack. She also told police that a woman with dark hair had been driving. So, Sergeant James Scott of the NOPD was stopped at a traffic light when he heard the description of the crime and saw the suspect being broadcast over the radio. He looked to his left, and there's Brown sitting in a vehicle that matched the description given by the victim's wife, and there was a female at the wheel of the car. Brown pulled the vehicle, Brown's vehicle was pulled into a nearby service station, and Sergeant Scott followed, believing the occupants of the car might be the suspects. The officer watched as a woman put gasoline in the car while Brown walked over to a water hose, and he began washing his hands. He then re-entered the car. Good point. Sergeant Scott approached the vehicle and ordered Brown to step out and place his hands on the hood. When Brown did so, the police officer observed scratches, marks, and droplets of blood on his forearms. He also observed blood between Brown's toes, which were visible through the sandals he was wearing. In plain view on the floor of the car was a New Orleans Shoppers card, which belonged to the victim. Wow, evidence is mounting up, right? He was arrested, taken into custody, and a search yielded Mr. Laughlin's wallet. A second search pursuant to property secured warrant led to the discovery of a Bowie knife, which had been concealed under the front seat of the car on the passenger side. Miss Laughlin positively identified Brown in a lineup and, you know, basically nailed that this is the guy that attacked my husband.
For those of you who don't know, a Bowie knife is a big-ass knife.
Yeah. Yeah. So, obviously, he goes to court. He gets convicted. He gets sentenced to death. And on April 24th, 1997, he was put to death by lethal injection at Bloody Angola. His final words were, "Let my baby sister know I love her and the rest of my family for supporting me. I love you very much. I'm ready to go now." As he felt the lethal drugs enter his system, Brown stated, "Wow."
Really?
That's it.
Wow. That's crazy.
Pretty crazy stuff. And those final words, man. Yeah. But, you know, I guess credit to the guy for not denying it.
Yeah, and not saying you got me bad. And
yeah.
To find the real murderer and all that shit, right?
Yep.
And he said, wow.
Wow, when he felt
hopefully
that stuff.
Hopefully he saw the face of Jesus.
Yeah. Could be.
All right. So, now, y'all, we'll take you to our next, whatever you want to call him. His name is Willie Watson, and he's a murderer. And And not only is he a murderer, he's a rapist and a kidnapper and a robber. And this offense took place on April 5th, 1981, and Willie Watson was born. I'm sorry, 1981, and Willie Watson was born in 51. So, and he killed a lady, Kathy Newman, who was 25 years old, and who was a Tulane University medical student. If you don't know that, if you're not from Louisiana, Tulane is basically the Harvard of the South. And he did so by shooting her in St. Charles Parish. All right. So on the evening of April 5th, 1981, Willie Watson abducted Kathy Newman, a third-year Tulane University medical student, at gunpoint as she arrived at her apartment building in the Carrollton section in New Orleans. Very familiar with that. Watson forced Newman to drive to an isolated area in St. Charles Parish, which would be towards La Place. He drove her across the bridge anyway, where he robbed her of her jewelry and raped and sodomized her. Right? Winner. Watson then instructed Newman to dress herself, and as she did so, he shot her in the back of the head, killing her. Right? Watson later confessed to the murder, saying he shot Newman because he feared that she could identify him. On June 5th, 1981, Watson was found guilty of first-degree murder. And Willie Watson was executed on July 24th of 1987. Watson was convicted of the kidnapping, rape, and murder, like we told you, of Kathy Newman. And when asked if he had any last words, Watson calmly shook his head. No. Let me read you the article. Words. This article is from the New York Times. It's right up after execution. Says Willie Watson, dates July 25th, 1987, New York Times. Willie Watson went calmly and silently to his death in an electric chair, gruesome Gurdy. Early, they didn't say that, y'all, it was me. Early today for the rape, robbery, and murder of the Tulane University medical student. He was the sixth murderer executed in Louisiana since early June and the second this week.
I remember they making it happen back in them days.
He was... the student, Kathy Newman, 25 years old, was abducted, raped, and shot. Now, not just raped, y'all, sodomized also, and shot to death in 1981. Mr. Watson, 30, confessed that he killed her, attributing the crime to his drug addiction while an adolescent growing up in New Orleans housing projects. And look, back then, they were real legit projects. Did I ever tell you about that? You could go, like... You could be on where Mike's house is on St. Charles and go two blocks in any direction, and they had the projects.
Yeah.
The big high-rises and shit. They had their own New Orleans police authorities for it. It was so bad, they wouldn't go in there in the daytime unless they had, like, three units at a time.
Wow.
But anyway, this is a desire. And
so he grew up rough.
It was rough. That was rough shit, the concrete jungle. So... the execution, which had been scheduled for midnight, was delayed 2 hours after the U.S. Supreme Court rejected Mr. Watson's appeal on a 4-4 tie vote. And Mr. Watson's lawyers made a last-minute plea to Governor Edwin W. Edwards, my boy, man, in Baton Rouge, and refused a final statement. At 1:58 a.m., Mr. Watson walked into the death chamber. His head had been shaved of the shoulder-wide afro, because he had a big fro-yo hairstyle he had the day before when he appeared at the state pardon board in a futile appeal. Asked if he wanted to make a final statement, Mr. Watson shook his head, no. He was then strapped into the wooden electric chair. Before, his face was masked, and y'all, they do that because the eyes fry out of the head and the hair, the scalp will catch on fire. Before his face was masked, he looked at his spiritual advisor, Sister Lee Scardina, in mouth, I love you, Sister Lee. Then he received the first of four jolts. Remember I told you earlier they hit it. Yep. They go, hit it. Turn it off. And they did hit it four times, right? Anyway. So then he received the first of four jolts of electricity at 2:02 a.m. He was pronounced dead at 2:09. After it was over, the spiritual advisor went to the Jed Stone, Mr. Watson's lawyer, who was outside the death chamber, and cried on his shoulder. Outside the prison, six advocates of the death penalty marched in the darkness. Now, I remember back in those days, that basically is the neighboring parish to where I grew up. And shit, I remember that they were rolling them three. And Governor Edwards was in office. My mom was on the parole board, parole and pardon board. And anyway, he was good friends with my dad.
Wow. And that was like 6 minutes they were jumping.
Yeah. Well, so you get, and they give them for like a minute, turn it off, give them another minute. And then, being morbid, but you know, fuck him.
It's a deterrent.
Killed a 25-year-old that was going to be a doctor. Raped her and butt raped her.
Yeah. Awful. All right. We're going to tell you, look, and this one's disturbing, so prepare yourself, but we're going to tell you about Andrew Lee Jones, and he was executed by electrocution on July 22nd of 91. Tell you about the crime. On February 17th, 1984, 11-year-old Tamika Jackson was living with her mother and grandparents in the Scotlandville section of Baton Rouge. Tell them about Scotlandville.
Yeah, it's I was just going to tell you, I'm about to do a full blown episode. I have all the research and everything on this case, and it's bad.
Yeah.
At Scotlandville, y'all, it's in North Baton Rouge, almost to Baker, what they call Baker, Louisiana, which is really Baton Rouge just runs into Baker. It's all still East Baton Rouge Parish.
Bad part of Baton Rouge. Yeah, and a lot of gang activity in that area. Yeah, it used to be way back in the day, decent area.
Back in this time, it wasn't that bad. But this dude is that bad. And again, the Real Life Real Crime original episode, you're going to get all the details. But go ahead, Joe.
There you go. So at 4 a.m. on February 17th of 1984, the grandmother discovered that the child, the 11-year-old Tamika Jackson, was missing from her bedroom. The police discovered that someone had broken the screen of the rear den window and had opened the back door. In the muddy ground near the house, police obtained a cast of an imprint made by a shoe from a pair of 8.5 size tennis shoes. There were no signs of a struggle inside the house. The investigation immediately focused on Jones because of his stormy romantic relationship of several years with the victim's mother. It had been broken off the week prior to this incident. The victim knew Jones well, and he had been in the home many times. On the evening of the child's disappearance, Jones had called the mother's home three times and had told the grandmother he would not be responsible for his actions.
Not going to be responsible.
If the mother continued to refuse to see him. About 6:30 a.m., the police went to the apartment where Jones lived with his sister, Terry Jones, and his half-brother, Abraham Mingo. Jones told the police he had been home all night, and Mingo and Miss Jones confirmed the story. A few hours later, Miss Jones called police and said she may have been mistaken about that. Mm-hmm. After questioning her further, the police obtained a written consent to search the apartment. When no one answered the officer's knocks, Miss Jones used her key to open the door, and officers found Jones in the bathroom washing a pair of size 8.5 tennis shoes.
Right.
The bathtub was full of dirt and leaves. The officer seized the tennis shoes and a pair of green gloves and requested that Jones give him a statement. After signing a waiver, Jones gave the police a tape-recorded statement, which he denied any knowledge of the offense.
I don't know nothing.
And, you know, the lack of evidence, so they had to allow him to leave with his sister. But approximately 6 p.m., the victim's partially nude body was found in a drainage canal.
In a ditch.
An autopsy established the child had been beaten, raped, and manually strangled. The police again questioned Mingo. Although he initially told conflicting stories, he eventually gave a detailed account of his activities with the defendant on Friday night and Saturday morning. According to Mingo, he and Jones were out with the defendant on Friday evening, but dropped him off in Scotlandville. About 1 a.m., Mingo and Jones went to the Snowflake Lounge, but Jones left about 30 minutes later and Mingo returned to the apartment. Now, at some point between 4:30 and 5 a.m., Mingo was awakened by Jones. He knocked on the door, whereupon he let the defendant in and went back to bed. When Mingo and Jones were alone in the apartment later that morning, the defendant told him he should have stayed home and that he did something he didn't want to do and that he done fucked up. Jones gave Mingo a TGMY bag and asked him to throw it away, which he did without looking inside. At Mingo's direction, police recovered the TGMY bag from a dumpster near a grocery store. The bag contained socks, a pair of blue jeans, and a pink sweatshirt, which were wet, muddy, and stained. Of course, they put some analysis on that and identified the stain as a mixture of blood and semen fluid.
Nice, before DNA.
Mingo also told the police about a pair of boxer shorts that he had found in the bathroom of the apartment. The shorts belonged to Mingo, but Jones had worn them that Friday night. Pursuant to Mingo's written consent, the police recovered a pair of stained brown and white boxer shorts. Analysis confirmed the presence of blood and semen fluid on the boxer shorts. On the basis of this information, they finally got a warrant. They arrested Jones. Jones gave a videotaped statement in which he asserted that he and Rudolph Springer had gone to the victim's house on Saturday morning to commit a burglary. They were scared of being recognized, so Jones remained in the car while Springer entered the house. When Springer returned carrying the victim, Jones got in the back seat and pulled his cap over his face. Yeah. After a few minutes, Springer drove Jones to his apartment. That was the last time the defendant saw the victim. That was his story. They didn't buy it. And eventually he gets sentenced to death. So he was executed on July 22nd, 1991. By electric chair. While he did not make a final statement at a pardon board hearing 3 days before he was executed, he said, "There's a possible chance I did it. A possible chance I didn't do it. If I had not been drunk, nothing like that would have happened. I'm like anybody else. I don't want to die or anything like that." So that was his statement after that. And, I hate it when it involves children.
Yeah,
it's disgusting.
I actually have some more in-depth knowledge on that case. I'm going to bring it to you on a original RRC episode in the future.
Very good.
And he is a real piece of shit. And I know of Mingo personally, and I'll explain all that.
So look forward to that, folks.
Right? Let's take to the next one. John Brogdon. Those just give you the facts of the case. On the evening of October 7th, 1981, Rubetta Brown and her 11-year-old sister, Barbara Jo, walked to a convenience store near their home in Luling, Louisiana. And y'all, that is in St. Charles Parish, again, down there in the La Place area and all that, kind of outside New Orleans, but across the swamp. So they walked to use the telephone. 19-year-old Brogdon and his 17-year-old friend, Bruce Parrott, arrived at the store while Rubetta was on the phone. Parrott approached Barbara Jo and put his arm around her. Rubetta called her sister away, and the two left. On the way home, Barbara Jo asked her sister if she could visit a neighbor's home for a few minutes. Rubetta allowed her sister to leave her to do so, and Rubetta went to the neighbor's house about 10 minutes later to pick up Barbara Jo. Barbara Jo wasn't there, and after a short search in the neighborhood, Rubetta informed her mother that Barbara Jo was missing, and they called the sheriff's office. After that, a friend of Barbara Jo's came forward to say that he had seen Barbara Jo earlier that evening in a car seated between Brogdon and Parrott. Two men discovered Barbara Jo's body later that evening behind a levee. And again, y'all, levees are high dirt walls, usually dirt, sometimes cement, hold back the rivers and the water. But anyway, they saw him behind the levee in Luling. Look, you got no fucking business being behind a levee, period.
Yeah, right? Especially in Luling.
Right. And Parrott's car was found parked a short distance away. Two other men later informed authorities they had seen Brogdon and Parrott walk on the road near this levee. Brogdon was without a shirt and appeared disheveled. Brogdon and Parrott were arrested that evening at Brogdon's home on the suspicion of Barbara Jo's murder. After being informed of his Miranda rights at the sheriff's office, Brogdon waived his right to counsel and confessed to the murder and aggravated rape of Barbara Jo. In his statement, Brogdon told how he and Parrott tortured and killed her. And instead of visiting the mother's home that night, Barbara Jo had returned to the convenience store and met Brogdon and Parrott. The confession, that's their story, y'all. Confession admitted that after they picked her up at the convenience store, Brogdon and Parrott drove her to the levee where her body was later found. They repeatedly raped her and forced her to perform oral sex on them. And all during these acts, they beat Barbara Jo with their fists. They also broke bottles on the cement and then stabbed her repeatedly with the edges. And Parrott also struck Barbara Jo in the head with a brick that he found laying nearby. And then Brogdon then beat her with the brick. The two also used pointed sticks to pierce her body. Brogdon and Parrott left the scene of the crime in Parrott's vehicle when they heard another car approach, and they hauled ass in Parrott's vehicle. Brogdon was convicted by St. Charles jury of murder and aggravated rape and sentenced to death. So he was executed on July 30th, 1987. Brogdon and his co-defendant, Bruce Parrott, were convicted of rape and beating. I told you about all that. Parrott received a life sentence, y'all, because the jury deadlocked in the penalty phase. I don't know what fucking...
some juror. The
idiot was on that jury. Brogdon made no formal final statement. As he turned to seat himself in the electric chair, his last words were, "God bless y'all." It's crazy, right? It's
horrible.
We do some really uplifting stories. We've done some great, great shit. But sometimes you got to let it be known why.
How the cow eats a cat.
Right? That's right. The worst fucking place in the world.
Yeah. And I mean, these people that are getting executed are not always angels.
I mean, they did everything to that girl.
Yeah.
But poor Holy
The blind woman. Right? I mean, that's just awful. Awful. Yeah. Thank y'all so much for supporting us. We hope y'all enjoyed this this episode, and we've got a part three that we'll drop at some point that you'll really like as well. But we just thank y'all for all you do for us.
And definitely, again, Patreon members, I hope you're enjoying your commercial-free early releases and all your bonus episodes and everything else. And you want to be a Patreon member, you can, go to patreon.com, type in Bloody Angola.
Yep. And it'll pull it right pull up.
In social media. Follow us on Facebook and look for Bloody Angola announcements and everything Real Life for Crime, including the Real Life for Crime app. And follow our other show, Real Life Real Crime Daily. Me and Jim and Mike Agravino. Original Real Life for Crimes, like the one I'm going to tell you about with Mingo involved in it. It drops on Tuesdays as of now, y'all. So
until next time, I'm Jim Chapman.
And I'm Woody Overton.
Your host of Bloody
Angola.
A podcast 142 years in the making.
A complete story of America's bloodiest prison.
Peace.
I walk a straight line, shackle and chain. Oh, gruesome Gertie is calling my name. There is no mercy in this penitentiary. Just ask the Hill String Gang, Wrangler.